Hello and welcome once again to Wayward Children, the podcast where we discuss Jewish myth, monsters, and the stories we tell. I am the wayward child hiding in your attic, John Baltusberger.
Hi, and I am the wayward child who's hiding in the back of your library. I'm Jack Zients.
That's a
great
good
talking
one.
To you tonight, John.
Dun, 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 dun. I think that's all we can get away with. I am known by a name on social media. That name is Kaiju Poet. Because I write stories about giant monsters. And whenever anyone asks me about writing Jewish stories, they always talk about the golem. And they're like, oh, can you make a golem a kaiju? And I'm like, yes, obviously I can. I slap them. But there's also kaiju that don't need to be made into kaiju. There are already kaiju.
So John, I'm going to jump in for a second, because before I started hanging out with you, I'm going to admit it publicly. I actually didn't know what kaiju was. So do you want to explain
absolutely
what kaiju is?
So the word kaiju means in Japanese, strange beast or strange monster. So it has a lot of different, like, almost anything could be a kaiju. A yokai could almost be, by that very narrow definition. However, via the via the evolution of language and what we typically mean daikaiju, giant strange monsters. And more specifically, the beast that gave birth to this genre was Godzilla or Gojira. Amazing.
Godzilla.
I have probably spent a good work week talking about Godzilla on podcasts at this point in my life. And I will more. There's a new Godzilla movie coming out from Toho. So, like, get in there. But, yeah, we're going to talk about giant monsters, and we'll talk about, like, where they come from and kaiju stories and what makes good kaiju stories and all that. But first, I feel like, speaking of giant monsters, we're both kind of tackling some big giant monsters in reality right now. What do you got going on, Jack?
Yeah, so John and I were talking this right before the podcast started, and he's like, Jack, we gotta like do this on podcast because nobody ever hears about this stuff. So we're just gonna digress for just a quick second. I am super active in my synagogue here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I am the new chair of the Cantor Search Committee. We are going hunting for the elusive beast, the new Cantor. And I was telling John that, like, every time a synagogue goes and does something like a clergy search or executive staff search, it's always different, you know, depending on the size of your synagogue or the moment in time, it's always different. But ours is really kind of crazy different right now, because we've had three different senior staff turnover. It just happened that way. Our executive director got a job she couldn't refuse. Our wonderful head of education, Rabbi Daniel Alter, decided that he didn't want to renew his contract. His contract was up, and he was a young guy. He was going to go off to a new synagogue because that's what they do. And Daniel totally did it right. And our wonderful cantor decided she was going to retire. And this all happened at once. And so our congregation went and did this huge information gathering exercise and pulled everybody from the congregation in and got lots of information. So as the guy who's leading the Cantor Search Committee, I don't have to go do that. And I'm really, really appreciative of them all doing that. And so that made it makes it kind of a weird thing, because I'm going to be announcing to the congregation, hey, we're doing the search committee, and I'm not going to have any meetings. You know, and everyone's gonna be like, wait, what? And I'm like, no, because we just had all of the meetings. And that's not true. Like, anybody who wants to talk to me, I'm gonna talk to you. And we're sure we're gonna have some meetings, but we're not gonna do this big thing like we would normally do. And so we have between now and June to hire a new cantor. And there's a whole process. Like, if you want to know what this process is like, just message me online. I can explain, but it's a whole process that we have.
So our synagogue is doing something similar. We're searching for a new head rabbi, which is huge. Now, Stephen Fulberg, our rabbi, has been our rabbi for 30 plus years. He brought me into the community. He married my wife and myself. He was there when my daughter was blessed, and Like, it's huge for us. But we also were doing a lot of reconstruction because our synagogue got attacked 2 years ago with the arson attack. And so we're having to rebuild and rezone and do all this stuff. So we're doing lots of these listening parties and community outreach.
Right.
And not to put too fine of a point on it, but I'm currently battling the biggest kaiju of all, cancer.
No doubt.
Which, for those of you listening at home, I am currently kicking its ass. My ability to taste sweet things is currently, well, my ability to taste sweet things and a couple of my body parts are the only victim thus far, but we're doing it. Okay. Kaiju.
Yeah. Let's get back to topic.
If you see this arm, listeners, you can't see it, but Jack can. I have Godzilla tattooed on one of my arms.
Oh, that is totally awesome.
For a long time, my logo was a picture of Godzilla wearing a kippa and a yarmulke. I called it Moshe Hamzilla. I love kaiju. I love giant monsters. They speak to me in a way very few other things do. Now, there's a few important things to a good kaiju story, because when you think of Gojira, when you think of Godzilla, Jack, I'm betting you think about like King Kong versus Godzilla, where they're giant monsters are punching each other and cities are being wrecked.
Yeah, I think of two things. I think of like Godzilla versus King Kong, Godzilla versus Mothra, like one of these big battles with two guys in rubber suits like whacking each other over some like cardboard Tokyo. So like I absolutely can picture that. The other thing I think of is Godzilla as like this epic cautionary tale with some Orson Welles voice saying, "And he came from the depths because we woke him with a bomb, and he is vengeance of the earth." I know nothing about kaiju.
Appropriate way. Now, I don't have look. I am not bashing versus movies. I love versus movies. I watch them. I eat them. I consume them. I adore them. However, the best Godzilla movies, Shin Godzilla, Gojira, Godzilla 1985. Those three movies are movies in which Godzilla stands by himself. There's no other monsters in those movies. Because it's incredibly important that nothing can stand up to the kaiju. They are a force of nature. In fact, it is in the contract that Toho signed with Legendary Films. Godzilla is not allowed to have emotion or emote in the Legendary Films, because he's supposed to be this force. And in Shin Godzilla and Gojira, he is a force of, very specifically, he is the force of nuclear holocaust and geopolitical power that is taking away Japan's ability to be an independent and self-sufficient nation. And if you look at it, that it's a terrifying, heart-wrenching film. And it's funny that, like, you watch some of the really campy Godzillas, it's like, how could anyone be afraid of any of this? And then you watch Shin Godzilla. There's this moment where the UN says, "We are going to nuke him if you can't stop him." And you see everyone in the room's faces kind of go ashen and just like staring off like, what the fuck do we do? So I say all that to say, the perfect kaiju story is not one where it's man versus kaiju, but man versus the realization of kaiju.
Which I have to say, I'm not the kaiju guy that you are, though I really need to go catch up them, because this might say something about my psychology, but like my favorite horror or thriller movies are usually ones where man is the bad guy. Cause
sure,
you know, we kind of deserve it. And so as much as like, I look at like, something like Godzilla as being the bad guy to destroy Tokyo, I'm also sitting there going, yeah, you know, that's fair. You know, we kind of deserve that.
If we keep going, I will talk about Godzilla entire 2 hours, and none of it will be Jewish.
Right. So let's get back to that. So the whole idea for this podcast was John and I were talking after the last one, and there's this great question that we were wrestling with, which is not, I guess it's a two-part question. Take your pencils out. You got to like be ready for your two-part question here. Part question number one is, are there any Jewish kaiju? Just what does the lore say? What does classic Jewish story say?
And if you haven't shouted yes yet, you aren't following either of us on Twitter.
That's right. That's right. So spoiler, we're going to say yes to that, but equally important to have there been, John and I love to talk about not just the lore, but about horror fiction and about fantasy fiction. And one of the questions is, so where do you go with a Jewish kaiju? Like, what would a new Jewish kaiju story look like? Because I'll tell you, from where I'm sitting, I don't see them, right? Like, there's some great Jewish horror fiction and John's stuff. There's great Jewish middle grade fantasy coming out. There's great, I was pitching on a great Jewish vampire story last week. There's all sorts of great stuff coming out, but I'm not seeing the kaiju here. And so like, that makes me wonder, right? Can somebody do that? And if they can't, why not? And if they can, why is it not more of a thing? So the first thing we want to do to kind of get at this question, because like I'm the lore nerd and John knows kaiju, is I'm going to give John a quiz. All right. I'm going to hit him with some classic Jewish monsters, and I want to know from John's perspective, are these kaiju? And I'm going to guess the answer to some is yes, but I might not guess right as to which ones he might think are kaiju. Okay. So, all right, John, are you ready to start?
Yeah. So I'm going to answer and tell why, and then I'd like you to tell me if you agree, disagree, or were completely wrong.
That's right. That's right. Because I'm wrong a lot. So we'll see where this goes. So, all right, let's start with the basics. Let's start with Shadim, Jewish demons. We had a whole podcast on Jewish demons. There's our second podcast. So let's just start there. John, is a shade kaiju, or could a shade be kaiju?
I think a shade would be more likely to be termed a yokai, or in European myth, a fairy. A fair folk rather than a kaiju. They are a force, but they are far too human to be a force of nature in and of themselves.
Okay, so that's like criteria number one. Like, they themselves individually or even as a group aren't really in the force of nature category. Is that like the big
that's
thing?
That's not a big thing, but you know, I'm looking at this from both Versus and standalone mm-hmm. kaiju movie kind of thought process of Shadim tend to be around human size. Mm-hmm. They are otherworldly, but so are lots of creatures throughout, you know, various folklore. Mm-hmm. And again, a single Shadim in a single story might represent an inevitable force of nature, but as a whole, that is not the whole Shadim fill in folklore.
That sounds good. So I would totally agree with you. Again, not being the expert here, I kind of had a much more simplistic thing. Yeah, they're just kind of small. I think of like Godzilla mm-hmm. as being this really, really big thing. And when I think of a shade, I'm like, yeah, like you said, about human size. Like, that's as deep as my thought process went. I'm like, yeah, they can fly. They've got wings. They can change shape. They're kind of badass, but they're not.
Although, counterpoint, I did at one point claim that Bell, the dragon, mm-hmm. was in fact both a dragon and a shade.
Okay. All right. So there may be some very special named Shadim. Okay. All right. So let's move on to the next one. You already mentioned it, the golem. So what do you think about a golem?
Absolutely not. How come?
So
kaiju can be man-made. They've been man-made many times in various cinematographic ooh, these meds. Golems have been kaiju have been man-made in many movies, many stories, but generally speaking, a golem is a thing. It is a mm-hmm. person or a chicken. It is essentially a person or being that is created by man, not mm-hmm. It is not created by nature. It is not. Okay. And this is a hard one, but generally speaking, they're not giant. They are mindless force of nature, but they aren't mindless in the animalistic or feral way. They are mindless in they are an empty vessel in which a wunder rabbi inputs like commands.
All right. So I am kind of on the fence on the whole kaiju-ness of it. So I buy everything you said. So, you know, they're generally human size, maybe a little bit stronger. You know, they're not giant, though. In any story that I've ever heard, it does raise the question for a enterprising Jewish fantasy writer: how might one create a giant?
Golem? Well, they might have to rip me off.
Well, I'll talk about that later. Oh, okay. All right. Never mind. It's been done. Go find your own idea. All right. Sorry. No, you can totally do a different version of it. All right. But I will say that there are a number of different themes in Golem literature. There is a theme that I'm really not very fond of, but it's a theme, and I'm not fond of it because it really got pushed by the German Romantics, who were really anti-Semitic. But there is a theme in Golem stories of the golem that where the rabbis created the golem and then loses control of the golem, and the golem runs around doing a whole bunch of bad crap before it finally gets killed.
I think that is the most famous thing when I'm talking to Goyim, right? They're like, Oh yeah, it's a story about you create a thing and then you can't control it. It's like, that's not actually the golem story, though.
That's
Frankenstein, which is a take on the golem story.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the golem stories and the way we understand them and the way they became part of world literature was really a function of the German Romantics and the Brothers Grimm being part of it. And they latched on to that version of the story, both because it is in the 1800s with the Industrial Revolution and science, like it was a very apt thing at the time, but they were anti-Semitic. And it was a great way to say all these stupid Jews, you know.
There's a fantastic look. Well, I promise we're going to do a Golem episode. Yeah. We have. I know. We are required by law to do it. But I will say, the only story of the Golem not being under control that I am aware of with the Maharal story, the Rabbi Lowe, is when his wife asked the Golem to clean the floors, and he didn't know when to stop, so he kept dumping buckets of water on it, a la the Emperor's Apprentice from Fantasia. Right.
And I will say that version of it, the kind of the Emperor's, the Fantasia version of it, that does ring true to Jewish storytelling, right? The idea that, you know, clever people can do bad things, but things can get a little bit out of control, but in a very gentle, not in a homicidal sort of way. But all right, that's enough about Golem. Let's move on. Okay. I'm putting a ringer in here. I know what your answer is going to be, but I have to do it anyway, just because it's my namesake on Twitter. What about the Adnei Sada? Can the Adnei Sada be kaiju?
So, yes, but
you said yes. I was so sure you were going to say no. All right, go for it.
My favorite kaiju that stands next to Godzilla is Biollante.
I have no idea what that is.
Oh, man. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Biollante is a rose bush that a scientist has implanted Godzilla's DNA into that is also haunted by the scientist's daughter's ghost, who was killed by Godzilla.
That is awesome.
And this is what it looks like.
All right, so not only does he have a tattoo of Godzilla, but he has a tattoo of Biollante on his arm too.
Fighting Godzilla.
Just to be clear, I am completely tat deficient, and it's actually been a problem in my life. Every year, I'm like, this is going to be the year I get a tat. It hasn't happened yet. Maybe this year, but those are awesome, John. We should pause for 1 second because unlike the Golem and Shadim, not everybody knows what Adnei Sada is. So let me just quickly explain so that John can get back to your crazed rosebush. It's just killing me. I have to see that one. So Adnei Sada is often referred to as the vegetable ape. Adnei Sada just means man of the fields. And the idea of it is it's an animate, one can say proto-human, because it kind of fits into the part of Jewish lore where God created them before people, but ended up going on and creating people because they weren't quite what he was looking for. So they're plants, they're vegetable, they're
huge
edible.
Mistake on God's part, in my
opinion. Well, I like I said before, I'm kind of cynical. Usually see us as the bad guys, so I'm with you on that. But the cool thing about Adnei Sada is while they can walk around, they have a vine that comes out of their abdomen, which goes to the ground to its roots. So it's rooted to the ground from its abdomen. And if you want to kill one, you know, because like, you know, they're tasty. They're like broccoli, right? You have to cut the vine, because if anything else, you'll just like won't do it. And there's a whole bunch of lore around them. They're awesome. So that's what Nandesadna is, which is why I'm like, yeah, like it's small, it's green, kind of homicidal, kind of a plant. It's totally not a kaiju. Small, then you said it was.
It is small because they haven't grown. There's in the beginning of the planet,
okay, all right,
all vegetation was mega flora.
All right.
Imagine a mega flora on Nandesadna.
Okay. All right. And,
excuse me. I'm just making a note for writing later. Horse radish. Okay. Good. I got my Passover story locked down.
Excellent. Well, it's funny you say Passover story, because like one of the classic Nandesadna lines, and I think this comes from Rashi, but don't be mad if I'm wrong about this. There is a line in during the plagues where Moses or Aaron, one of the two of them, threatens Pharaoh, saying even the ground will rise up against you. And the commentary, which I think is Rashi, says that what he's referring to is Nandesadna rising up out of the ground
that
and attacking.
That makes me so happy. That's so cool to know that. Some of the most amazing Mishra and Talmudic weirdness comes from the Passover story.
Oh, absolutely. Someday we'll just have to do like a Passover story version of this. But okay. So we got to keep the pace going here.
Yes. We have so much.
So I'm going to do one more I'm going to tell you right now. I think you're going to say no to this. And then I want to move to some of the big ones where I'm going to guess the answer is going to be yes. And I saved them for last.
Okay.
All right. So a Dybbuk.
No.
What do you think about this?
Okay. But one of the Godzilla movies, I think Biollante actually, Godzilla is a conglomerate of the ghost killed in Pacific Wars, and is supposed to represent the dispossession of Japan and the lack of national spirit in Japanese youth.
Okay, so another way to say that is a single Dybbuk, maybe not, but all of the Dybbuk
all of the Dybbuk
jammed together, they could
in
be...
In one Adnesada.
All right. Okay, so now, again, Jewish fiction writers, I'm waiting. Come on, get at it. All right? Okay, so let's step it up a little bit. I'm going to move us up to... what I think you're going to agree are kaiju, but you'll have to let me know here. The Ziz. What do you think about the Ziz?
Ziz is absolutely a kaiju.
How come?
Everything I've read, it's probably about the same size as Rodan, the fire monster kaiju.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, it's also a rock, right?
And by the way, just so we don't lose the audience, right? Because as soon as you say it's a rock, he doesn't mean R-O-C-K. So the Ziz is a really big bird. Depending on the story and the version, it could be as big as, let's say, the eagles in the Lord of the Ring, where like, you know, one person would ride on them, or the claws could grab two people, about that size, all the way up to like epic, stands out in the middle of the ocean, and the ocean only comes up to its knees kind of size. So when he said rock, he means ROC, which is the Arabic version of the smaller sized Ziz. So please, back at you.
One of the amazing things about Jewish folklore and Jewish language is that a lot of the language used to describe creatures or God or angels, they want it to be the language. This is my frustration with taking things literally in scripture and religious text, is as a poet, as someone who writes myself, I've written crazy things. And no, I don't mean that the thing's wings literally stretch across the world and cross on the other side. But you will read that sort of thing in Jewish fiction and Jewish lore. But yeah, it can easily pick up an elephant in its talons. It's a kaiju.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Like one of my favorite bits about the Ziz is that a mama Ziz has like two Ziz, and the Ziz has a nest, and one of the eggs falls out of the nest and the egg cracks open and it drowns three towns and knocks down a whole forest. I'm like, come on. Total kaiju action.
I want that omelet.
Well, yeah, you and it, about 800 people could all join in.
It's good breakfast.
Good breakfast. Style. Okay. So again, stepping up here, and we're going to come back to the Ziz in a second because they're all kind of tied together at this point. But the next one is the Behemoth. What do you think about the Behemoth?
I'm going to say yes.
All right. I'm going to agree. So again, just like the Ziz, the Behemoth is the second of the great animals. There in Jewish lore, there are three like epic class animals. The Behemoth is the great land animal. It sometimes is described as, or it's in Job, where it's described as having the qualities of a great ox. Job doesn't actually say that it looks like one, but all of classic lore kind of goes off and thinks that it looks like an ox. There's lots of synagogue art where it looks like an ox. Later, there's some modern academic work that kind of suggests that maybe it was actually supposed to be like a hippopotamus or a rhinoceros. And so
I always say behemoth, but I've seen behemoth pictured as a hippopotamus before, and I think it's a really good I like it for two reasons. First, whenever you see Middle Eastern giant animals, you tend to circulate towards the crocodile, or not the crocodile, sorry, the elephant.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like the elephant or the hippo is kind of taking it in our own direction, so yeah. I like that a lot.
Sure.
But also, hippos are both really adorable and terrifying.
Oh, they're horrifying. They're yeah. just huge. They're the kind of animals that look at you and go, you're nice, crunch.
And they're angry nice, about that. It too.
Yeah, no doubt. So when we talk about the Behemoth, like we're getting into the part of Jewish lore that to me that is as kaiju as it's going to get, because we're getting into like the messianic animals, and by and Ziz is one as well, but not quite as much. And by messianic, I mean there is these stories that are the cosmological side of Judaism, creation, the creation stories, and then the world to come. And both Behemoth and then the next one we're going to talk about, Leviathan, are specifically talked about in Genesis. And then they're talked about in Job and Isaiah and in later Jewish lore as being associated with like the end times, like these great battles that'll happen right before the end of the world. And then, by the way, after when the world to come happens, there's going to be a feast and there's snacks. Behemoth burgers is going to be a thing. I'm personally excited about Behemoth burgers. I have a question
for you about the Behemoth burgers. Do you think Abraham will be cooking them, and will he serve them with cheese?
So that's a great question. I would say
you know why I'm asking that too.
Yeah, well, because I would say definitely no on the cheese, but I would say I'm doing it. But like but the why? Point you're making,
why? Why? Because he serves the angels cheeseburgers, and it is rabbinic tradition that Abraham followed all the mitzvot.
I know.
Serve the meat and cheese.
All right. All right.
The meat and dairy. Ergo, okay. Ergo, I get to have Bema cheeseburgers in heaven.
Okay, I'm not going to argue the point. I see where you're coming with that. We're just going to have to wait and see on that. Okay, so the last one that I'm going to hit you with, and I think I'm just going to say, this is as kaiju as it gets. At least I think so. Is Leviathan? Are you
Leviathan
with me on
Leviathan? Leviathan is the honestly, Leviathan may be too big to even be a kaiju, right? Because Leviathan follows the tradition, not follows traditions, but is in the same tradition as like Jormungandr, The World Worm.
I don't even know what that is. What?
So Jormungandr? Yeah. Jormungandr is the world serpent in Norse mythology.
Oh, okay.
It circles the world and like bites its own tail, and that's like when there's earthquakes, it's because the serpent is like rolling in the ground. And Leviathan is, in my estimation, Leviathan is the depths of the ocean. The Leviathan is the Leviathan is absolutely a kaiju because it represents the primordial chaos, but also represents the unknowable, terrifying depths of the ocean, which for us, we just had a bunch of people try to go down there and not make it.
Right.
To ancient people who just occasionally see weird animals wash ashore and be like, whoa, that seems rough.
No, I totally hear you on that. And like, and I'm glad you like you said chaos of water, because like, even as much as Behemoth is part of this, but Leviathan absolutely symbolizes the chaos water, the primordial water. In Hebrew, it's referred to as Tehom, which is just the deep, right? Right there in the first phrases of Genesis, right? You have when God created heaven and earth, the earth being uniform and void with darkness over the surface of the deep, Tehom, right? And Leviathan is right there in Tehom. And, you know, there are these great epic stories of God fighting with Leviathan, or sending his angels off to womp on. By the way, this is like my favorite stories. According to some of the Jewish lore, there's going to be this final battle with the angels, and the angels are going to total wuss out and run home, and God is going to have to go stomping in because the angels just couldn't do it. That's how tough.
My boy.
That's right. He cannot handle Leviathan. But so here's the funny thing, though. As much as there's a different Leviathan, so that's one Leviathan tradition, which is like, I'm God, I'm tough, I'm going to kick Leviathan's butt. Like that is, you know, that chaos water, like I creation is mine, I made creation, forget about all that. But there's another tradition where literally, and I joke, kid you not, Leviathan is basically God's puppy dog.
Right. I was seeing that. God takes a moment to play with Leviathan.
That's right. That's right. According to the lore, God's day is broken up into sections. And every day there's a 3-hour block where God sports with Leviathan. God goes and plays with Leviathan. And honestly, I think that's nice because God also like killed Leviathan's mate. Right. So I want to talk about
that real quick.
Yeah.
Because Leviathan did have a mate. But this brings up something much more important.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking, look, Jack and I haven't done a great job of this yet. The Jewish culture, including Jewish folklore, is heavily dependent on food. We are a hungry people.
We
already mentioned Behemoth Burgers, but what we did mention is that Leviathan's mate, at least, is smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, my friends, Leviathan is not a serpent, because serpent is not kosher. Leviathan must have gills and scales.
Right. Yeah.
Leviathan is a salmon.
All right, so I'm going to have to – we have to stop there for a second. So this is something I know I've said in an earlier episode, but I'm going to repeat it right now. This is like my mantra whenever I'm talking to people about Jewish lore. Jews are amazing at commentary, and we suck at taxonomy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what I mean by that is there is no one right, like, canonical thing that this is the thing. So there are three different legit ways to describe Leviathan, like, or picture Leviathan. One of them, as John was just saying, is a big salmon. And so there is synagogue art all over the world that will have pictures of a big ox, the behemoth, and a big fish, often in a circle, and that's Leviathan. My buddy Elizabeth on Twitter is constantly posting these amazing images of like Leviathan and Behemoth artwork. So if you follow me, I retweet her stuff all the time. I don't know where she finds it, but it's amazing. So that's one, the big fish, right? And for, like John said, it has to be a big fish because it's kosher. Now, number two, Leviathan is a dragon, There is no question according to the Lord. So I have to read you guys something. I'm just going to, every once in a while, I just got to like, just read the text so you can hear, like, this is not just, this is literally what the text says. So I'm going to go to Job, and there's a section of Job, which is the Leviathan section. It's absolutely amazing. And this is very much in the God is going to kick Leviathan's butt part of the Lord. Here is how Leviathan is described in Job. Who can pry open the doors of his face? His bared teeth strike terror. His protective scales are his pride, locked with a binding seal. One scale touches the other. By the way, does this sound like Smaug in The Hobbit? Just a bit, right? Not even a breath can enter between them. They cling to each other. They are interlocked so that they cannot be parted. His sneezings flash lightning, and his eyes are the glimmerings of dawn. Firebrands stream from his mouth. Fiery sparks escape. Out of his nostrils comes smoke, as from a steaming, boiling cauldron. His breath ignites coals. Flames blaze from his mouth. I mean, come on. As his dragon as you get. And it really, he is described multiple times in the lore as being either a flying serpent or a fire-breathing serpent. Like, he's a dragon. Like, that's the other legit way to do it. But there's a third. There's What's a third? And I actually didn't know. I had missed the third. And again, my friend Elizabeth online posted it or tweeted about this morning in her private story. Or not private story, but I forget what the right Twitter term or X term is, but her communal thing.
Oh, communal X.
Yeah.
That's just what you do at a festival, man. I don't know what's going on over there anymore.
Exactly. So anyway, a hydra. So there's a lion.
Really?
Absolutely. There is a description of Leviathan as having multiple heads that then God will crush. God has crushed each of the heads of Leviathan. And that is linked or it's thought to be linked by scholars to older Sumerian and Canaanite myths of like the seven-headed monster that one of the gods would go and kill. Okay. And I always get a little iffy on some of those pre-biblical to biblical comparisons. The scholars, the academics argue a lot about all that stuff. It's changed a lot over the last 100 years, the current state of the thought on that.
Yeah.
And so like that's a little out of my league. But that's the third one. And there's again, it comes directly from the text that Leviathan has multiple heads and that God crushes the heads. Which
I think that, you know, you mentioned being bad at taxonomy and sorting and this. Part of the problem is you have to remember that none of this was written in one sitting by one person.
Right.
This stuff is written over hundreds, if not thousands of years. Orally for most of the time. You know, whenever you get more than one writer in the room, one of them is always wrong. And now you have, you know, possibly hundreds of different writers. Anyway, I say all that to say, it's still cool as hell is the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's super cool. I didn't know about the Hydra thing at all.
Yeah, like literally that was today. She posted that and asked, hey, does anybody know about this? And I'm like, yeah, I missed that one entirely. Because unlike the dragon version of Leviathan or the big fish version of Leviathan, those two are really common in the lore. Like I said, like their synagogue are all over the world for the fish version. And the more dragon lizardy one is just core in the Torah. I don't know of any other place other than the actual Torah where that phrase comes from. I started looking around a little bit. I haven't had time to put a real search in, but like, yeah, that one doesn't get popular. Rabbis don't like that image so much. That doesn't do anything for them. So they kind of,
I think part of the problem is, you know, we Jewish people have always, we always tried to differentiate and stand apart from assimilation. And when you look at assimilation, especially, at 0 BCE, CE times, when Hellenization is a huge concern, and hey, they have a hero fighting a Hydra.
Yeah.
That'd be a myth that I wanted to bury, honestly, if I was doing things. I would want to separate it as much as possible.
No, absolutely. I mean, that easily could have been it. I really don't know. I do want to correct myself. Specifically, the image of Leviathan having multiple heads comes from Psalms. I think I said Job on that.
Well, but it comes from the Psalms. Now, how are you going to listen to anything David writes and say he's not just being a flowery artist? All this.
Maybe. But he was the flowery artist.
Yeah, so he was the prototype.
All right. So, listen, we've gone through a bunch of them. Like, I think we've kind of built ourselves up from shitty, probably not, up to Leviathan, which is so kaiju. It may be over the top kaiju, right? But there's no question that like the Jewish tradition has incredibly epic monsters.
Sure.
I think the only thing that for me undercuts Ziz, Behemoth, and Leviathan as kaiju, and this is like, I want to kind of toss this at you to transition to like, where do you think like a Jewish storyteller might go with this?
There's one other thing I need to talk about before we get into that though.
Do it.
Why are all the Jewish kaiju kosher? Because I was thinking about every culture has. I'm a very hungry person.
Dude, it's totally true.
Every culture has sea monsters because going out to sea was deadly and it was terrifying. The Kraken. Like, why? Cephalopods are not kosher. They're unclean. Why don't we have a Kraken in Judaism? The answer is because we can't eat it. It's very obvious to me.
I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Cannot eat it, and ergo, we are not interested in telling stories about it.
Yeah, so talking about telling stories, the question I was going to ask, or the thing I was going to pose to you that almost, to me, undercuts the kaiju-ness of Ziz, Behemoth, and Leviathan is there aren't really people involved in those stories. Not actively.
Not, it's not like Leviathan isn't going up into Babylon and crushing towers and knocking over the Hanging Gardens. Right. But if you sail out at sea and you sink, well, you may have come across Leviathan. If your body is found smashed against the rocks near a river, well, they may have come across Behemoth. These stories are coming from a time when life wasn't as crowded as Tokyo, as Austin. These are stories that take place in places where, well, if there's a giant monster, just leave that town with your four belongings. It's fine.
That's right.
And so much of Jewish horror, ancient Jewish horror, happens in ruins and in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Because we write about the things we don't understand, the things we don't know. So people are being killed by these things. People are interacting with these things. People had visions of these things. It just wasn't mass destruction that we know. But again, we have to look at this from the lens of like, what were ancient people thinking was a mass? We have stories in the Torah where, a group family rode into town and circumcised everyone, and then the next day killed everyone in the town. You have your balances, and the bad guys in the Torah generally are people.
Yeah, no doubt. The part of Deuteronomy, if you read the weekly Parsha, like the part of Deuteronomy we're in right now, there's a lot of God saying, yeah, could you just go over the hill and the town over there? Yeah, just kill them all. No, I meant all of them.
Yeah.
No, go back and kill the rest. There's no doubt about that.
But I think what I want to say about though is that when you look at kaiju stories of biblical nature, we tend to look at them today through the lens of us telling stories as this is a grandiose way of saying, like, look how cool God is because he's doing this. But imagine for a moment you're a kid sitting at, your synagogue, and you say, well, what's this thing about God and Leviathan? And the rabbi, who is a practiced storyteller, just launches into this cinematic oral story about God fighting this crazy dragon from under the ocean, and how it's like, he's so mighty, he sent the angels after him, the angels had to fight this dragon back, but couldn't. It was just slaughtering angels. It was killing angels, dude.
Right.
And then God had to stand in, and he had a hard time even. Even God struggled to fight down the chaos of the Leviathan. And in the end, God was able to vanquish the Leviathan, and that is what he serves on the bagel and lox.
That's right. Like, that's right.
And that's we are getting, in the Torah, in the Talmud, we get the theatrical poster, but in the synagogues, in the schools, in the houses, they were talking these out as massive stories and poems that they told to each other and got each other psyched out. There were kids having nightmares about this, not because it said, and then God fought a dragon, but because their dad or their uncle had a little too much wine and just went crazy with the descriptions.
When my kids were little, I have two daughters, one's in college, the other's just about to go into college. But when they were little, I would tell them stories all the time. And let me tell you, some of them got really wild.
And exactly. The kids loved
it. Absolutely. I don't think
what I think happens.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think there are a couple of ways. I'm not a writer, but I think there are a couple of ways like a writer could take on like the idea of like some of these critters as kaiju. Like you and I have talked a little bit about cosmological horror, mm-hmm. right? And I always love like, you know, we tend to go back to H.P. Lovecraft. It's like the king of cosmological horror, but there's lots of other stories where there's just something that's a little bit too big for humanity to deal with. And I would love to see stories where, you know, Leviathan. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention there's some great lore about Leviathan and Behemoth like fighting each other.
Yeah, yeah. Like that's right? A big,
right? It's a big deal.
Energy right there.
Right. And I could easily see like a story where like, you know, humans have absolutely nothing to do with this. Like yeah. We're just kind of here. But but this end game is playing out with them fighting each other and the angels stomping on them and getting chased away. And like, what the heck happens to New York when like, we're just the collateral damage in one of these epic battles. I would love to see like, you know, stories who has a great, like that.
This is not my recommendation. It is a recommendation, but not for this week. Brian Keene has a book called Earthworm Gods, and where Earthworm gods fight like a Dagon-esque fish thing, and the world is flooding, and there's worms. It's choice. So I found out recently that a lot of reviewers consider my work War Dictates to be cosmic horror.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because it's so much bigger than humanity can deal with. And in that, I write, I want to say an entire chapter about Leviathan, like under the ark and what's going on there. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting when you're doing stories like this, is you have to create tension for the people that people are going to care about while creating the big set pieces that are happening overhead and linking those two in a way that will be engaging. So for instance, in my book Abhorrent Siren, which is not Jewish at all but is a kaiju story, I think people actually see the kaiju twice. And in all other terms, they're either dealing with things that are fallout from the kaiju or these smaller monsters that are more of an interpersonal level. And if I were going to tackle like end time behemoth versus Leviathan, I'd probably do it in such a way that there's people fleeing cities because these monsters are crushing the cities. And I would focus on doomsday cults coming to terms with a more Jewish-esque end time.
Oh, cool. For sure.
And we did, we published a book by Andrew Fox called End of Days, which is kind of a Gonzo Bizarro End of Times thing. It has robot Jesus. It's very weird.
So if you're into a Robo Jesus, there's a book. There's a book for you.
There's a book there. So the key component to a good kaiju story, in my opinion, is that it can't be about fighting the kaiju.
Right.
Or if it is, all efforts to do so are nil. The kaiju, people complained about the new legendary Godzilla movies. Like, oh, Godzilla was only on screen for this much time. Like, if you look at Gojira or the old Godzilla movies, their runtimes of monsters on screen are like 15 minutes. They're very short because the good movies especially are always about human reaction to the inevitability of whatever is happening. And I would stick to my guns. I would say Leviathan is primordial chaos. Maybe Behemoth is primordial order. And that mixing is what's happening. The Ziv is such a good monster to throw because then anything can fly. It's over for humanity.
Oh, sure.
Like when you're watching a King of Monsters and Ghidorah's just flying through the air, it's like, humanity can try. Like, there's no real way this would end well for anybody. I would probably want to add a fourth kaiju. I would have Behemoth be the, and I would have it, you know, air, water, earth, and fire. So I would probably have a surviving Nephilim rise from a volcano, and that the four of them would be coming together because there's Kabbalic tendencies towards the four elements that make up everything.
Yeah. You go with a salamander. Like, there's a whole Jewish lore about salamanders who live in fire.
I love salamanders, but they're often also related to Arabic myth. And I would want to not disrespect Arabic mythology through ignorance on accident.
Sure, I guess I only bring it up because there's some core Jewish stories about.
I mean, fiery salamanders. They're part of Arabic mythology because they're part of that world's. Sure. You know, greater zeitgeist mythologies. But I know that they're more ingrained in Arabic mythology than in Jewish mythology. So I always hesitate to abuse any faith or mythology that I don't clearly understand. That's not true. I ride roughshod, dog. all that said, I think the important thing to do is to find the links to these monsters that are fascinating to you, that draws you into them more than just big monsters cool, and then play those dynamics out on smaller and smaller nodes until you get to the core of whatever characters the story's revolving around. So that kind of goes out in macro as it happens in micro.
Love it. Love it. So I am not a fiction writer, but that sounds exactly right to me. I'm just, like I said, I'm just picturing, you know, Leviathan going nuts and I'm like, I'm in.
Oh,
and
as a movie, I would just have them crushing it. It would be
absolutely.
I don't know. I would also have a tender sex scene between the Leviathan and its mate before it was killed. It would be very erotic and very visual.
So I have to ask, though, when you are picturing that to yourself, are you picturing the fish version or the dragon version? Because I'm not sure where you're going with that. Because
I'm picturing a polykill between all three versions.
Oh, God.
It's not very kosher, right. By the way.
No. All right. I'm just going to maybe on that note, we should wrap this up because we're clearly getting a little... I think we jumped the shark right there.
Oh, no.
All right, John. So to wrap this up, we always like to have a couple of things for people to go home with. Yes. I think you do. What do you got?
So I'm going to do two today. I've decided that as opposed to telling you about Jewish research stuff you can do, I'm going to leave that to Jack. I'm going to be your horror connection on this show. Yeah. And But I do want to wean that a little bit. So I'm going to suggest a book by Zach Rosenberg, The Long Shalom. Most recent work. It is a cosmic horror Jewish noir. It features queer characters. Great author. I actually just recently wrote a short story with him.
Oh, fun.
But go check out Zach Rosenberg's The Long Shalom. And the other book I want to recommend is none other than Blood and Mud by John Baltusberger.
Who, if you're not paying attention, is you.
Me, yeah.
That's right.
When a good man is senselessly murdered by white nationalists during a Chicago gay pride event, Satan reaches a breaking point with humanity and summons a horrifying golem to make mankind pay for centuries of sin defying his brothers and sisters in heaven and the armies of men. Blood and Mud is a gut punch of a book that you never saw coming. It also includes an essay on Jewish occultism and mysticism, and the golem in this book is in fact a kaiju.
All right, that's awesome. So I've read a lot of your stuff, John. I have not read Blood and
Mud. It's my very first novella, so it was one of the first things I put out. A lot of people haven't read it, but it's available on paperback, ebook, and audiobook.
Awesome.
Read by awesome. By Sean, whose name last name I can't remember. He's a great guy, though. Great reader. But it's available on Audible. Please check it out.
Excellent. Okay, so I have a book and a website I want to recommend. So all right, I'm going to hit you. So we talked a lot about Behemoth and Leviathan. And so one of the best books, if you want to kind of dig into the Jewish lore on this, is called Two Strange Beasts, Leviathan and Behemoth in the Second Temple by K.W. Whitney. Whitney not only handles the Second Temple period with a lot of the lore we're talking about, but he does a nice job kind of summarizing the current state of academic thought on how the biblical texts relate to pre-biblical texts, which I still get a little lost in myself, but really, really good book, very readable through most of it.
Now, Jack, before you do your second recommendation, I realize neither of us recommended this. What about Sacred Monsters?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we have to today.
Sure. So I'm pausing because I'm like rolling back. So
yeah.
So another great text, Sacred Monsters, is a very ironic book. It's ironic. So Sacred Monsters is called Sacred Monsters, Mysterious Mythical Creatures of Scripture, Talmud, and Midrash by Rabbi Natan Slifkin. Slifkin is a fascinating guy. He's super active on the internet. He is a Orthodox rabbi in Israel. I forget which museum he works for. And he has written like the definitive book on Jewish monsters in the Orthodox community. And everybody should read it. I will tell you, if you want to get a copy of it, go to the publisher's website. I think it's Geffen is the publisher. Yeah, Geffen Books. This is geffenpublishing.com. And I'll tell you, buy it directly from them. Because if you go to Amazon, you're going to be like, that jerk, Jack, told me to get this book that's like $70 and there's like one copy. No. There's just no resale market on the book. If you go and buy it from the publisher, you have no problem buying it. But the reason why I say it's an ironic book, oh yeah, John's got a copy. I've got a copy.
I got mine at Half Price Books for $10. I'm sorry.
All right, there you go. There you go. Excellent. So the reason why it's ironic is because while Natan Slifkin is an absolute expert of all of this material and wrote this definitive book, he is a rationalist, which means that every chapter in the book picks up a different critter, starts with the lore, and then has him going off and explaining why the rabbis didn't necessarily really mean it. And totally undercuts, you know, so like we're here all excited about all this cool stuff in the lore, and he's almost trying to make it all go away. But at the same time, you know, he does this really great explanation of core parts of the lore. So it's a fantastic read. And the end of every chapter, you kind of like, aw. That's how you ended it? All right. So that's my second. Well, I'll go with that as my second one. I'll leave my other website for a different one.
I didn't want to leave it off. And
no, of course.
You for me personally, getting into that, like, here's what the rabbis probably were talking about, doesn't demystify it for me. I am more than happy to have both the rational and the irrational living side by side in my weird little heart. God, this is a fun show to do. I'm glad I get to do this show with you, Jack.
Me too, John. This is great. All right, we should wrap up.
Yes.
This up.
Why don't you go first? Tell me about our music.
Oh, right. So I have to give credit where credit is due. Our intro and outro music is the song Skin and Bones by Yoshi Fruchter, performed by his band Patone.
It's so very good. You should check out, there's a link in our show notes. You should check out that and probably buy it too, I think.
Yeah. Yep.
Go ahead.
Yep. And he has a new band called the Sandcatchers, which does a very different kind of music. A lot of oud based, more Arabic sounding, but it's absolutely phenomenal. And you should check that, his new band out.
I'm going to listen to that tonight. Friends, thank you so much for joining us on Wayward Children. I have been the wayward child hiding in your attic, waiting to gnaw on your bones while you sleep, John Baltusberger.
I've been the wayward child hiding in your bookshelves, ready to jump out and grab your ankles, Jack Zients. You can follow me on the internet at Twitter, where I tweet at Adnei Sada, or on my blog, JewishMonsterHunting.com.
And you can find me at Linktree/KaijuPoet. Thank you so much. We will be back in 2 weeks. Until then, don't go into the ruins.
Don't go into the ruins. It's a ruin down there. Good night, everybody.